Today is Thursday, April 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden says he's withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan because the country cannot justify staying there two decades after the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon.
I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war.
Plus, how did the crisis in Ethiopia's Tigray region develop? And how the world's oceans are under multiple attacks. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Joe Biden says that he will pull the last U.S. troops out of Afghanistan this year. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani starts us off.
The president says the U.S. has achieved its original objectives, taking out Osama bin Laden and degrading the al-Qaeda threat. After 20 years, he says it makes no sense to stay any longer.
I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war.
And the final pullout of 2,500 U.S. troops will start next month. The GOP response is scathing.
You have not ended the war, you have extended it.
With Lindsey Graham saying the president's essentially canceled an insurance policy against another 9/11. Moments after the president announced the U.S. pullout, NATO said it too will pull all non-American forces out. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Earlier, the Taliban spokesperson tweeted that it seeks the withdrawal of all foreign forces on the date specified in the Doha agreement, which is May 1st. The tweet continued saying, quote, if the agreement is breached and foreign forces fail to exit the country on a specified date, problems will certainly be compounded, and those who fail to comply with the agreement will be held liable. End quote. Prior to making his announcement, President Biden spoke with Afghan's President Ashraf Ghani. According to the White House readout of the conversation, President Biden emphasized that the United States will continue to support the Afghan people, including through continued development, humanitarian, and security assistance. President Biden and President Ghani reaffirmed their shared conviction that every effort should be made to achieve a political settlement so that the Afghan people can live in peace. However, the United Nations said on Wednesday the number of civilians killed and injured in Afghanistan during the first 3 months of 2021 had been significantly higher than a year ago, calling on warring sides to urgently find a way to stem the violence. The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan recorded in its report close to 1,800 civilian casualties, including 573 deaths, a 29% increase compared with the same period in 2020. It went on to note a worrying 37% increase in the number of Afghan women killed and injured and a 23% escalation in child casualties compared with the first quarter of the previous year. Meanwhile, Afghan officials said on Wednesday clashes with Taliban insurgents and a militant car bombing have killed and injured more people, including civilians. Taliban officials have rejected the report's findings. Female journalists in Afghanistan are also calling on Kabul to include their representatives at a peace talk to ensure media and women's rights are protected. Bejan Hamdard narrates this report.
At least 8 journalists and media workers, including at least 4 women, have been killed since peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban began. A Human Rights Watch report says the Taliban is targeting journalists, including women.
We have many concerns over the targeted killings of female journalists and activists. We hope this summit has a positive outcome for issues related to women.
That's part of the reason why a group of female reporters has told the Afghanistan's peace ministry a female journalist must be included in the Afghan delegation headed to Turkey for peace talks. The goal is to ensure their rights are protected in any deal with the Taliban.
The upcoming Turkey summit is crucial, and we need one female journalist to be there and inform us about what is happening.
The Afghan delegation has said repeatedly it will defend the rights of women and journalists in talks with the Taliban. But the journalists want greater assurances.
We don't accept that we should share our wishes with a middleman. We as journalists want our own representative at the Turkey summit and for it to be our own voice there expressing what we want.
The Turkey summit is important for the peace talks process, but the talks have not reached a level where the government can discuss every issue with the Taliban, said State Minister for Peace Affairs Said Saadat Mansour Nateri.
We had an important meeting with President Ghani, where he shared the political map to peace with us. When we speak about the Constitution, it's important to us that we defend the rights of women in the peace process and the Constitution.
At least 30% of those participating in peace talks should be women, says Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission. Its chief, Shahrzad Akbar, says she is concerned about the lack of public information on the government agenda for the Turkey summit and that an all-male delegation is not a good formula for success. The summit is due to take place in Istanbul later this month. For Samsam Asirat in Kabul, Afghanistan, Bejan Hamdath, VOA News.
Tuesday, a Taliban official tweeted that the group would not attend the summit. The Kremlin said on Wednesday that a summit between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his U.S. counterpart Joe Biden would be contingent on U.S. behavior. This after reportedly telling Washington to scrap a plan to impose new sanctions on Russia. Reuters' Soroya Ali has the details.
The Kremlin isn't saying yes to a proposed summit between Presidents Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin, but it isn't saying no either. It would depend on Washington's behavior, Russia says. As the conflict in eastern Ukraine surges again, Biden called Putin on Tuesday to propose a meeting of the estranged leaders to tackle a raft of disputes. Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov played down the prospect of a summit early on Wednesday, saying it was too early to talk about it in tangible terms. He later said the summit was contingent on future U.S. actions, according to the RIA News Agency, in what looked like a reference to potential U.S. sanctions. Russia has been preparing to be hit by new sanctions since Biden said last month that Putin would pay a price for alleged Russian meddling in the November 2020 U.S. presidential election. Moscow denies interfering. Meanwhile, the Russian Navy began a military exercise on Wednesday ahead of the expected arrival of two U.S. warships in the Black Sea. Moscow has warned the U.S. warships to stay well away from Crimea for their own good. Russia seized Crimea from Ukraine in 2014, and fighting has increased in recent weeks in eastern Ukraine, where government forces have battled Russian-backed separatists in a seven-year conflict that Kiev says has killed 14,000 people.
Soroya Ali reports for Reuters News. The third week of a murder trial of a white police officer linked to the death of an African-American man he arrested continues in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin on Wednesday, a defense expert blamed George Floyd's death on heart trouble. The AP's Ed Donahue.
Prosecution experts testified George Floyd died from a lack of oxygen after being pinned down. Forensic pathologist Dr. David Fowler testified.
Mr. Floyd had a sudden cardiac arrhythmia.
As a result of his heart disease, Fowler listed other factors.
Fentanyl and methamphetamine. There is exposure to a vehicle exhaust.
Potentially carbon monoxide poisoning. The medical examiner ruled George Floyd's death was a homicide. Fowler said there were too many conflicting factors.
I would fall back to undetermined.
Tape from court TV. Prosecutors say Floyd died because Derek Chauvin's knee was pressed against Floyd's neck or neck area for 9.5 minutes. I'm Ed Donahue.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine will remain in limbo for a while longer. That word coming from U.S. health advisors that told the government on Wednesday that they need more evidence to decide if a handful of unusual blood clots were linked to the shot, and if so, how big the risk really is. The reports of the blood clots are exceedingly rare, 6 cases out of more than 7 million U.S. inoculations. On the second day of the traditional New Year holiday, opponents of Myanmar's coup splashed red paint and dye on roads and signs outside government offices Wednesday to represent the blood of people killed protesting against the junta. The display aimed at shaming the military took place in various towns and cities, according to pictures posted by media outlets, as people answered a call by activists to join what they termed a bloody paint strike. There is no immediate reports of violence at any protest, but information has become scarce because of junta curbs on the internet. The five-day New Year holiday began Tuesday, but pro-democracy activists canceled the usual festivities to focus on their opposition to the generals who seized power. In addition, the Free Burma Rangers have increased aid in the border regions of the Karen State, the site of the recent airstrikes by the Myanmar Army. The Rangers are a multi-ethnic humanitarian group that has aided oppressed ethnic groups, mainly in Myanmar, and reported on the conflicts for more than 25 years. The group has worked in other countries, including Sudan, Syria, Iraq, and Kurdistan. Steve Sanford brings us this story.
In Myanmar's Karen State, thousands of internally displaced people, or IDPs, are desperately seeking food, shelter, and medical aid following increased government attacks in recent weeks, including airstrikes. For David Eubank and the Free Burma Rangers, where more than 30 teams are currently in Karen State, the challenges are daunting.
And so our teams move to where the fighting is, and right now our teams are with every displaced group, giving medical care, helping people who are wounded or sick, also coordinating to bring food in, bringing tarps for shelter because people are hiding in the jungle, and then telling their stories and trying to get the news out so people in the world know what's happening.
Many of the members of the FBR are ethnic Karen, including the group's deputy director, Kaypaw Say, known by his nickname, Monkey. A former resistance fighter in the Karen area of Myanmar, Kaypaw Say has seen much pain and suffering over the years in his war-torn homeland. Now he helps document human rights abuses, taking photos and videos with the aim of helping friends and relatives who remain in the country.
Right now, the villagers are in trouble. Our FBR medic teams are working to rescue them from the violence. At the same time, our families, wives, and kids have to run and hide in the jungle and the caves.
It's a traumatic experience for the internally displaced persons, many of whom have faced repeated upheaval in the past, in a conflict that's lasted more than 7 decades. But one of the most damning developments, according to Eubank, is a new method of air attacks being used by Myanmar forces.
In over 25 years of working in Karen State, I've never seen a bombing, and now we have them every day. The other surprising thing is the indiscriminate nature of their bombing, killing civilians, mostly civilians who are killed. But that's exactly what they're doing in Rangoon and the other cities. They're killing civilians, kids, women, it doesn't matter. So it's the same. It's just what weapon they can use.
As the crisis in Myanmar shows no signs of letting up, humanitarian groups both within the country and abroad are expected to increase relief efforts for all civilians. Steve Sanford for VOA News, Chiang Mai, Thailand.
As the United Nations Security Council prepares to meet on the ongoing situation in Ethiopia's Tigray region Thursday, VOA traces the beginnings of the conflict that has grown into a humanitarian crisis. In early November of 2020, the federal government of Ethiopia, led by Nobel Peace Prize-winning Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, launched a military campaign to regain control of the contested region from the Tigray People's Liberation Front fighters. Heather Murdoch explores the human costs of the armed clashes, which have reverberated across neighboring countries, destabilized communities, and displaced hundreds of thousands of people.
The conflict in northern Ethiopia has displaced hundreds of thousands of people and rattled the region. Observers fear instability in the largest country in the Horn of Africa could spread beyond its borders. Here's how it got to this point.
On November 4th, 2020, forces loyal to the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, attacked federal military bases in northern Ethiopia, according to the federal government. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said the attack crossed a red line and ordered the military to confront TPLF forces. This, he said, came after months of provocation and incitement. On November 6th, the Ethiopian military said it launched a campaign to retake TPLF strongholds in the north using precision airstrikes and ground forces to attack military targets, including Tigray's largest city, Makala. However, TPLF officials say there have been civilian casualties, including non-military targets, such as schools, places of worship, and infrastructure. To understand the roots of the conflict, you have to go back decades. Tigray, Ethiopia's northernmost region, played a vital role in the country's recent history. TPLF was an armed political movement that helped liberate Ethiopia from the brutal Derg regime, which finally fell from power in 1991. Then, a Tigrayan ex-fighter, Meles Zenawi, led the new coalition government in 1991 that instituted a system known as ethnic federalism, which divided the country along ethnic lines into 10 regions with some autonomy. Meles and the coalition of political parties he founded, the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, or EPRDF, held near total control in the country. Political dissent and free speech were severely restricted. But the country also enjoyed rapid economic growth during Meles' time in power, with impressive advances in the industrial sector. Still, ethnic resentment also grew. Tigrayans comprised only 6% of the population, but held outsized power in the military, business, and politics. Meles died in 2012. Widespread protests followed, leading to the resignation of his successor, Prime Minister Halimeriam Desalegn. Then, Abiy Ahmed, a young ethnic Oromo, rose to power in 2018. Abiy instituted a raft of reforms, including negotiating a peace deal with neighboring Eritrea and releasing political prisoners. In 2019, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. But some of Abiy's reforms also deepened divisions. In 2019, he dissolved the ruling party, the EPRDF, and created the Prosperity Party. The TPLF refused to join the newly created party. By September 2020, the feud escalated. The Tigray region held elections, defying the central government, which had postponed national elections because of the coronavirus. The central government called the elections illegal. The rift grew in October when the central government suspended funding for and cut ties with the TPLF. Tigray's administration said this amounted to a declaration of war. And once the war began, it quickly escalated. On November 14th, the conflict spread in the region beyond its borders when the TPLF launched rocket attacks against neighboring Eritrea. TPLF leaders accused Eritrea of involvement in the conflict and said the country was a legitimate target because Asmara Airport and other locations in Eritrea were being used to support Ethiopian federal forces. On November 28th, days after surrounding the city of Makala, Ethiopian federal forces retook the city center, its airport, and military base. On the same day, Abiy declared an end to the conflict he termed a law enforcement operation. But later, TPLF's leader, Debretsion Gebremichael, vowed to fight on. The ensuing conflict has already involved neighboring states and shaken the Horn of Africa, which has long viewed Ethiopia as a pillar of regional stability. As is often the case in war, the most vulnerable people bear the brunt of the conflict. Cellular service and internet access in the region have largely been cut off. Communications blackout makes it nearly impossible to get accurate information about the conflict and its humanitarian cost. Tens of thousands of civilians fled Tigray, many on foot or on rickety boats across Ethiopia's Tekeze River, crowding into refugee camps across the Sudanese border. Although the fighting slowed in late December, its impact continues, with tens of thousands internally displaced and seeking refuge elsewhere. In Tigray, aid workers were denied access to refugee camps by the federal government. Relief agencies warned of continued dire conditions in what they called a full-scale humanitarian crisis in the region. As access to parts of the Tigray region is still restricted, the UN and other organizations say some people have died of starvation and many more are at risk in addition to the spread of COVID-19. Refugees in the camps in Sudan say they won't return to their homes because they fear for their safety, and the long-term direction of the conflict remains uncertain.
This is Science in a Minute.
El Niño or La Niña are two opposite climate patterns that originate near the equator in the eastern Pacific Ocean. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, weather, wildfires, and ecosystems around the world can be affected when either of them are active. A new study from researchers at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, and NASA suggests that the end of the sun's roughly 11-year solar cycle may be linked to a switch between the two climate patterns. While many scientists are uncertain how changes in the sun can influence Earth's weather, the study authors say their research shows it does and explains why the connection between them may have been missed for years. Rather than examine the solar cycles over 11 years, the study researchers developed a 22-year solar activity clock for more precise measurements. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. France's once powerful Communist Party is fielding its first presidential candidate in years for the 2022 election, and Lisa Bryant has that story.
C'est ça la politique du président des riches.
The French Communist Party's presidential hopeful is Fabien Roussel, a former journalist with a reputation as a bon vivant, an amateur fisherman who has been at its helm since 2018. He got strong backing at a party meeting last weekend, although the movement's base must still endorse his candidacy next month.
Notre projet pour la France s'inscrit dans cette histoire dont nous sommes.
Announcing his run Sunday, Roussel said he wanted to offer the French people a program of hope, not only in defeating the coronavirus pandemic, but also unemployment, poverty, and inequality. France's century-old Communist Party was once a major political force. In the 1970s, it was the country's most powerful leftist party with about 20% popular support. It also governed a raft of working-class towns around Paris, nicknamed the Red Belt, with streets named after communist icons like Marx and Lenin. Today, it's a shadow of its former self, although it's among a handful of communist parties across Europe with deputies in the European Parliament. Here in France, center and far right candidates have pierced the Paris area red belt, and the communists now control just one French department. The party's last presidential hopeful, Marie-Georges Buffet, got less than 2% of the vote in 2007. Roussel was partly elected on his call for another run. Political analyst Jean Petou says Roussel's move is almost an existential decision for the party. If the communists don't field a candidate, they risk disappearing altogether. If they do, they risk another humiliating defeat. The immediate outlook isn't very promising. A meeting this Saturday aims to unify France's fractious left, which runs from the Greens Party and far-left leader Jean-Luc Mélenchon to socialist Paris mayor Anne Hidalgo. Supporters hope to find a single candidate for next year's presidential race, but Mélenchon, one of its most powerful figures, says he won't attend. Even if the left unifies, political commentators say it's unlikely Roussel will leave lead the ticket. If Roussel runs on his own, that will further divide the left. Either way, things look grim for the communists and other leftists. An IFOP poll Sunday found President Emmanuel Macron and far-right leader Marine Le Pen leading in voter intentions for next year's elections. It found no leftist candidate would score more than 13%, and Roussel only capturing 2.5%.
On voit bien que le retour d'un état protecteur.
Analyst Petou says it's a paradox since the coronavirus crisis has left some French hungry for the kinds of messages the Communist Party has long embraced, like the return of the protector state. Yet even among the working class, the party has lost its shine. Many have turned instead to Le Pen's far-right national rally. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The world's oceans, on which all life depends, is under a triple threat from climate change, loss of biodiversity, and overfishing. An ambitious new study published recently in the journal Nature says that if the world's nations were to protect 30% of the world's oceans, it would increase fish stocks, preserve existing biodiversity, and maintain marine carbon stocks, which contribute to climate change when released by industrial fishing trawlers. The report was authored by 26 scientists from a wide variety of disciplines. Now, to find out more about the report's findings, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Nigerian-born Rashid Somaya. Professor Somaya is an interdisciplinary oceans and fisheries economist at the University of British Columbia in Canada. He began their conversation by explaining how scientists can work to save the oceans, diverse ecosystems.
You need to understand the science, you need to understand the economics, you need to understand the social culture, the legal. So yeah, it's bringing all the perspective to the table because people and nature interact.
In the past, what has been the overall approach in protecting biodiversity, mitigating climate change, and promoting sustainable economic development, especially regarding fisheries and such?
Before this study, people were looking at the effects of climate change separate from the biodiversity and separate from the food and livelihood.
And the studies made insight regarding this?
When we talk about conserving nature or conserving the ocean, we are also at the same time talking about future jobs and food. They are intertwined. So you cannot take down nature and hope to continue to get what nature provides us, which is every basic thing that is important to us. The fish, the forest, the oil, the gas. We take them into our economy, into our cultural, social systems, and then we produce waste and we put them back into the ocean, into nature. If we don't do the taking wisely and we don't take care of the waste that we produce, we are going to destroy the basis of life.
So the ocean matters to everybody, not just those living on the coastlines and fishermen, etc.?
Yes. If you are in Abuja, not by the coast, and you think that the ocean doesn't matter to you, you are making a mistake. Because through trade, we get fish to eat, whether you are in Abuja or in Nairobi or in Cape Town, right? Also remember, the ocean produces half the oxygen on Earth. Without oxygen, we're all gone. So preserving nature links with our food needs, our livelihoods, and also leads to climate. And that is the point of this paper.
So what does the paper actually say?
Essentially, what the paper says is that if you protect the ocean, up to 30% of it, could be more, then you buy yourself insurance. You build in resilience in your system. And actually, you also can reduce your cost of fishing because the protected area becomes more productive and you can catch the fish cheaply without burning too much carbon and making CO2 and climate change. And in the report, there are specific data for each country in Africa. For example, in Nairobi, the report has found out that the amount of the ocean protected fully from fishing is zero. So that means Kenya has a lot to do. Then you go to South Africa, they have about, if I remember well, they have about 2-3% fully protected. So each country can see where they are doing well. And then the amount of fish you can get more if you do this protection, you know, how many jobs can you create a livelihood? So you can see where you are and how to increase your food, protect the environment, and also deal with climate change.
It sounds quite doable.
It's a 3-point dividend there. Win, win, win. If only we can do it.
It must be frustrating for scientists like you when policymakers hesitate to adopt these ideas.
Absolutely. It's almost like you see the path, you see the way to really improve the lives of everybody, and yet we just go on doing all the things that really destroy nature and us ultimately. So yeah, this is tough, but my own way of tackling this is we have to be optimistic. We have to keep pushing. So let's keep going. Africa will do well if we put things in place.
Rashid Soumaya is at the University of British Columbia, and he was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.